Lecture 8, Gilgamesh.
In our last lecture, we explored the world of the Quran and saw in the figure of Muhammad, one of the great prophets whose revelation of the Quran, given to him directly by God as the Muslims believe, truly transformed history. The Quran is a book that made history, that continues to make history. The Quran is also, by our definition, a great book. Its theme is a truly grand one. It is quite simply God. Who is God? What does God demand of us? God, Muhammad said, will place no burden upon you that you cannot bear. And he said this in the noblest of language. The Arabic of the Quran is believed to be the perfection of language by Muslims, and hence there has only been one authorized translation of the Quran done under the Ottoman Empire, and the Arabic of the Quran is studied and recited all over the world of Islam. And that speaks to the third of our definitions, its universality, able to speak to men and women from very diverse civilizations and cultures, stretching all the way from Indonesia to the United States itself, where Islam flourishes. It is sometimes said with concern by modern Westerners that the Quran provides an entire social and legal framework for the Muslim, as though that somehow were an oddity. In fact, as we shall see in our study of Gilgamesh, as we shall see as we go through these great books, we are the oddity, in that we separate the world of the divine from the world of the human, the world of the sacred from the world of the secular. You see, to Moses, to Jesus, to Muhammad, it would be incomprehensible why there had been such a furor some months ago about putting a copy of the Ten Commandments into a hall of justice. These are laws. They are to regulate legal affairs, are they not? Do not kill. There are laws against killing upon our books. Do not steal. So without taking a side on this, you understand, I am merely putting this forth for you to ponder. It is nonetheless the fact that most of the great books that have been written believe that the divine is truly part of the world of humans. And the great civilizations of the past, India, China, Greece and Rome, Mesopotamian Egypt, believe that there can be no dichotomy between the sacred and the secular. There can be no separation of state and church. That is one of the lessons in the magnificent epic, the Gilgamesh, that is the subject for our lecture now, and that enables us to focus upon the next of our great themes, which is the question of fate. What is fate? Muhammad gave an answer to that. Everything that befalls us is destined by God. It is written. God has decreed everything that is going to happen. And that too was a message of Marcus Aurelius. It has consumed the mind of thoughtful individuals since the first days of civilization. Civilization was born in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, in other words, in the Middle East, around the year 3000 BC. It was an astonishing burst of anonymous creativity that in Egypt and in Mesopotamia simultaneously saw the birth of and development of writing, complex government structures, monumental architecture. From the time writing begins to develop in Egypt until the pyramids are raised, those monuments that still awaken our awe, only 500 years had passed. And the birth of writing in the Middle East was shortly followed by great structures that the Bible would recall as the Tower of Babel. Mighty monuments, both the pyramids and the Tower of Babel, the ziggurats of Babylonia. Monuments to this belief that there is no separation between the sacred and the secular. Mesopotamia, the land of the two rivers, what we would call Iraq today. Their civilization blossomed in the form of independent cities, like Uruk, like Ur, like Nippur, that arose there where a complex governmental structure came into being to regulate the irrigation of the land through these rivers. The same way that in Egypt, civilization came into being when a political figure, the Pharaoh, became powerful enough to organize the labor, material resources to carry out large-scale irrigation, so that the population, both in Mesopotamia and along the Nile Valley, were released from the vagaries of the weather, and where large cities and settlements could grow up and feed themselves. Now, in both Mesopotamia and in Egypt, this did not come about through democratic government. It came about through absolute power. And we must deal, as we ponder the lessons of the past for our own day, that such a growth of technology and the harnessing of technology in the third millennium BC was made possible only by absolute government control. In Egypt, this came about by the population of the Nile Valley accepting the belief that Pharaoh was God on earth, the good God, he who makes the cool waters flow, and building the pyramids to celebrate his eternity, that he would live forever, God on earth, and then God dominating the underworld when he seemed to pass away from us. And this did not come about through peaceful cooperation. It came about through warfare. And the first historical document we have from Egypt that we have writing upon that tells us something about the history of Egypt is a pallet, that is to say a slate object on which cosmetics were ground, a ceremonial pallet of the king Narmer. And what is he doing on that pallet? He is bashing his enemies' heads in and cutting them off and marching in triumph. So the celebration of absolute power. So too, in Mesopotamia, these city-states that arose along the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates were based upon absolute kingship. In this case, the king ruled because the gods had chosen him, placed him upon the throne. And the very name of some of these kings celebrated their grand status. Lugobanda, the big man. It was here, the civilization of Mesopotamia, that our first epic poem, extant to us at least, came into being. The Epic of Gilgamesh. And its theme was fate. What is our fate? Because man puzzled over the question of, why do I die? Why can't I live forever? Why am I one day vital, moving around, and the next day dead? And where have I gone if I have died? And with it came this desire to live forever. Flee from death, the Egyptian pyramid texts tell us. Let us carry out every ritual possible to stave off death. Let us fill our tombs with goods and objects and food that will enable us in another world to continue to live. In Mesopotamia, this same question lay at the basis of the epic Gilgamesh. Now, civilization in Mesopotamia came into being in the person of the Sumerians. The Sumerians spoke a language and wrote their language, the first written language in Mesopotamia. This was a language that was not related to the Semitic tongues that later came to dominate. Semitic being a language family that includes Hebrew, it includes Arabic, it includes ancient Babylonian, it includes the ancient language of Akkad, a region of Mesopotamia. And the Sumerians celebrated very early on, in the form of tales which were written down, the figure of Gilgamesh, The man of joy and the man of woe, they called him. He was a real historical figure who sometime around 2600 BC had been king of the city of Uruk, what in the Bible is called Erech. And the Bible in Genesis recalled a figure like Gilgamesh and the figure of Nimrod, the first mighty man who ruled over Babylon and Erech. So Gilgamesh was a real historical figure, a powerful king, who was credited with, and I think did, build the walls that surrounded the great city of Uruk. Those mighty walls that are a symbol of the ability to organize labor, and also of the constant warfare that dominated the life of these Mesopotamian towns. Uruk of Gilgamesh. Sometime around 2100 BC, a longer poem was written about Gilgamesh. And almost from the beginning, the Epic of Gilgamesh was conveyed in the form of writing, rather than simply oral composition. This poem was written down in the language of Babylonia, the language of Akkad, and a Semitic language. And later on, perhaps sometimes towards the end of the second millennium BC, a final elaborate version was committed to clay tablets, and the name associated with it is Sin-liki-unununi, whom we might credit with being the first great poet that we know by name. This was then copied, and examples of it were found in clay tablets of the king of Assyria, Ashurbanipal. For the Assyrians, the Semitic people, had come to rule over this vast land of Mesopotamia, in fact pushing their empire all the way to the Mediterranean Sea and for a time dominating Egypt, the Assyrians. Thus was the long history of the Epic of Gilgamesh. From Sumerian to Babylonian to Assyrian, it awakened the interest of an educated audience. And stories about Gilgamesh were also told in popular oral form around campfires and in caravan trades and throughout the Middle East. So Gilgamesh was a real historical figure who became the subject of mighty legends. The Epic of Gilgamesh, this first great epic poem, is the story of how Gilgamesh looked into the abyss. That is how the poet John Gardiner called it, who was fascinated by the Gilgamesh. Looked into the abyss. And what is the abyss? It is the fact that you are going to die. You are going to die. And no person can escape that fate. But Gilgamesh, like all of us, wanted to. Ever hear of the writer William Saroyan, a famous American writer, middle part of the 20th century? He said, "I knew everybody had to die, but I thought an exception would be made for me." And Gilgamesh wanted that exception made for him. And so the Gilgamesh epic is a story of his quest for eternal life. It begins in the city of Uruk, with Gilgamesh as ruler and flaunting his power. He's a great, huge man, mighty in figure as well as in power, virile and vigorous, handsome and striding back and forth and celebrating his achievements. "I built the city of Uruk," he says at the beginning. "I built the city of Uruk. It has 1 square mile of city, 1 square mile of gardens. There is 1 square mile of clay pits where we dig out the clay to make the mud brick walls and townhouses of our city of Uruk, and a whole half mile devoted just to the worship of our goddess Ishtar." For the world of Gilgamesh is a world of many gods, of polytheism. And the world of Mesopotamian religion was filled with demons, divinities, much like the gods of Homer, very human. And this makes them, you see, very accessible. Very accessible. The gods of Homer, like the gods of Gilgamesh, eat, they drink, they fall in love, they get tired, they can even be wounded on the field of battle. They can even be overcome from time to time by mortals. They are like you, and hence you can approach them and understand them and placate them. And they intervene directly in the world of humans. They do it by oracles in the world of Mesopotamia and in Egypt and in Greece, and they do it as well by dreams. They tell you what they want done. So the gods of Mesopotamia, like Enlil and Anu, Shamash, the god of oracles and justice, or Ishtar, the goddess of love and the special patron of the city of Uruk. These were all very real figures to Gilgamesh and to the people of Mesopotamia. And intervening constantly in the world, choosing who will rule, setting up codes of law, they make it certain that there is no separation from the world of the divine and the world of humans. And Gilgamesh himself is testimony to this because he is two-third divine. His mother was a goddess, and his father, Lugubanda, was part divine as well. So he is called two-thirds divine. And he struts back and forth, abusing his power as we would see it. Why, he forces the people of Uruk to do his bidding. He forces them to make the bricks and build these great walls in which he alone takes enormous pride, takes credit for them. And he even takes away your bride. For to him belongs the right of the first night. From the umbilical cord onward, that girl is devoted to me, and I will have her on the first night, says Uruk. Says Uruk, ruled over by Gilgamesh. But the people of Uruk don't like this, and they think Gilgamesh is out of control. In fact, he is exhibiting, from their point of view, what a Greek would call what? Hubris. Outrageous arrogance. So the people of Uruk appeal to the divinities. You have got to help us against this king, Gilgamesh, who is running amok like this. And the divinities listen. They hear their pleas, and they decided that what we must do is send down a person strong enough to contend with Gilgamesh, put him in his place. So they create the wild man Enkidu. As big as Gilgamesh, as strong as Gilgamesh, but he comes not to this city life, but to dwell out in the country, grazing on the grass with the gazelles, accepted by the animals as one of their own, drinking at their water pools with them, knowing nothing of all the folly of civilization that makes us weak and corrupt. And there he dwells in happiness until the people of Uruk say, we've got to get him to come and help us. Now, how are we going to take someone who knows the joys of living out in the big lonely, that is the world of nature, and get him to come to a city? How would you take somebody who lived in the beauty of Montana and bring them to Washington, D.C.? Who would be foolish enough to do that? Well, let's send him a woman. Let's send him a prostitute, Shamat. But you see, it's not just the kind of prostitutes we might have in our mind. No, no, these are temple prostitutes. And temple prostitution is a fundamental aspect of the religion of Mesopotamia. And a temple like that of the goddess Ishtar, the goddess of love, is filled with young women. Some of them, in fact, most of them, are working to earn their dowry so that they can buy themselves a husband. And it is not a dishonorable occupation. It is an honorable service. And Shamat is a prostitute of intelligence and beauty. And she goes out to talk with Enkidu. And she seduces him. They spend 7 days and nights together. It says, vigor flows into her, in the words of the Gilgamesh epic. She teaches him to shave, to bathe, to drink beer. 7 jugs of beer make him feel good and happy. To eat bread instead of the grass that grows out where the gazelles graze. And suddenly, the gazelles want nothing to do with him. The lions want nothing to do with him. He has become civilized. He has that stench of civilization. And his friends, the antelope, run away when he comes. So there's nothing left for him but to go into the town of Uruk. There he arrives, and the people flock out to welcome him, and they say, you're the one who has come to save us from Gilgamesh. And right now, Gilgamesh is about to take a young maiden getting married. Stop him. And Enkidu says, this sounds outrageous to me. I will go and stand in the doorway of the home and fight Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh strides in. Where's my wife for the night? You can't have her. Who are you? I am Enkidu. Well, I am Gilgamesh. Then let's fight. And they do. And in the great tradition of folklore, like Mike Fink and Davy Crockett fighting, they have this mighty struggle until Gilgamesh beats him. And we even have a seal of the scene with Gilgamesh kneeling on one knee and holding great Enkidu up. So he has conquered him. "My golly, you're a man," says Enkidu. "You're a man too," says Gilgamesh. "Let's be friends." "My mother told me about you," Gilgamesh says. "I had this dream. I had a dream in which there was this mountain that I had to deal with, and these stars that fell down, and then this giant stone axe that I had to move and struggle with, and then I gave a big kiss to." "My mother said you're going to find a friend like that who will come and be your friend and share all things with you. That's you, Enkidu." "Well, I am so glad. And let's not worry about those girls who keep taking it. Now, that sounds all right to me. That's not such a bad thing to do." "Well, you know what? Now that we are friends, what we've got to do is to really make a name for ourselves." "That's what I've got to do," Gilgamesh said. "I have got to make a name for myself so that people will remember me forever. Let's go destroy the monster Humbaba." "Humbaba? Oh, that's a terrifying creature with a human face and the body of a monstrous, monstrous, gigantic creature. Why, his breath is like death. His maw is like fire. His body is like iron. We will go and conquer Humbaba, who dwells in the great forest of the cedars far to the west where the sun goes down." And Enkidu and his friend go. All along the way, Enkidu stops and makes a shelter for his friend Gilgamesh, sprinkling flour around him where he can receive dreams. Oh, you will push this aside and think it's just some maudlin sentiment by Dr. Fears. But to the ancient world, dreams were real. Not something to be explained away by psychology or too full of a stomach, but reality. And the gods conveyed to Gilgamesh through their dreams the struggle that he and Enkidu will have against great Humbaba and the dangers that lie in that victory. But they go and find Humbaba, and their struggle is magnificent. The very ground shakes as Enkidu and his friend Gilgamesh fight this huge monster and conquer him. And the monster in his pain shouts out, "Save my life!" And Gilgamesh looks upon him and says, "Well, he's not such a bad monster." And Gilgamesh says, "Let's let him go." And Enkidu says, "You got to kill him. You got to make a name for yourself by killing him." "Don't kill me," says Humbaba. But Gilgamesh slays him. And from the forest of cedar, there in what we would call Lebanon today, great trees are cut down and floated back down the river Tigris and Euphrates to build a mighty shrine for the gods, so that forever men will know of the great victory of Gilgamesh and his friend. The goddess Ishtar now, in her graciousness, comes to Gilgamesh and says, "I want to become your mistress." And Gilgamesh, who has slept with all these other girls, says, "I don't want anything to do with you, Ishtar. Everybody who becomes your boyfriend dies in a terrible fashion. Look at Dumuzi. Why, he was just a happy shepherd, and you destroyed him. The lion, you broke his spirit. The stallion mated with you, and you turned him into this creature who befouls his own water and is the subject of man. Look at the gardener who did nothing but bring you beautiful fruits to eat. You turned him into a scarecrow when you were done with him. I will have nothing to do with you." So Ishtar flees to her father, the king of the gods, and says, "You've got to help me. I have been spit upon by this mortal Gilgamesh." And her father sends down this huge bull of heaven to ravage the land. Once again, you see the divinities intervening directly in human affairs. And Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu slaughter it as well. Humbaba, the bull, both of these symbols of chaos, they conquer. But such victory must have its price. And Enkidu has a dream in which he is told he will die. "I don't want to die," said Enkidu. "It was a terrible experience. My soul went down into this deep pit, and there were all the kings that had ever been, and their crowns were as dust, and all the wealthy men, and their money was as nothing. I don't want to go." But he dies, and his friend Gilgamesh can do nothing to save him. Sorrowing beyond any comprehension, Gilgamesh decides that he will not die. And he goes in search of eternal life. His mother, the goddess, tells him, "It is something no man has ever found, eternal life. No, wait a minute, Mom. Isn't there something about one man, Utnapishtim? I've heard about him. He lives forever. Oh, but he dwells far, far away, past the dreaded mountains, across the sea of death. You cannot find him. I'm going to try. I am going to leave my city of Uruk and go in search of eternal life. And so he goes to the west. League upon league upon league, he travels and travels and travels until he comes to the dreaded mountains, guarded by the scorpion monster. You cannot go through. And Gilgamesh begs and pleads until the wife of the scorpion monster intercedes and says, give him a chance. See if he can go through the great tunnel that runs through these mountains. But the sun comes through that mountain at the end of the 12th hour every day, and he will be burned alive. No man can get through that mountainous tunnel in 12 hours. Give him a chance. And Gilgamesh runs as no man has ever run before, through that mountain, running and running and running. And just as he crosses out of it, the sun comes through, but he is safe. And he makes it to the Sea of Death. And there, upon the Sea of Death, in this desolate area, he finds another woman, another harlot, the female interfering and intervening for him, who says, you look terrible. Who are you? Gilgamesh. You can't be Gilgamesh. You're emaciated and exhausted. It's Gilgamesh. You're in search of eternal life, aren't you? Yes. Across those waters indeed dwells Utnapishtim. Gilgamesh convinces the boatman to carry him across. And he must pole his way across, and to allow his hands even to touch the Sea of Death is to die. So Gilgamesh poles and poles, and each time his hands get near to the water, he drops that pole and takes another that he has cut. So he carries out every possible labor until the boatman has brought him across. And he meets Utnapishtim and his wife. You're immortal. Yes, and I live forever. How did that come about? I don't think you know about the flood, do you? No, we haven't heard about the flood. Well, here the city of Nippur, yes, it's an abandoned city. Well, I, Utnapishtim, lived in Nippur. And the gods decided that they would destroy the human race. And the king of the gods came to me and said, build an ark. Build an ark and put two of every creature upon it and your family. Tell no one why you are building it. And when everyone asked Utnapishtim, why are you building this ark? He said, the gods will send a shower of abundance. And they did. A mighty flood came, and the human race was wiped out, and the creatures of the world were wiped out. And I alone, with the creatures I had saved and my family, we sailed on that ark, day after day amidst the terrible rains, until we came to rest upon a mountain. I sent out one bird, and it came back. I sent out a second bird after a few days, and it brought back a twig. The waters were receding. And I sent out a third bird, and it never came back. And for all my suffering, the gods have given me eternal life. And Gilgamesh asked, well, tell me how I can live forever. You cannot live forever. Mortals must die. I am the exception. Give me a chance. And the wife intervenes and says, let him try. Utnapishtim says, you can be immortal if you don't fall asleep. Immediately Gilgamesh falls asleep. And knowing that he won't believe it, Utnapishtim has his wife bake bread and puts a loaf of bread beside Gilgamesh each day that he sleeps. And when Gilgamesh wakes up and says, I haven't been asleep at all, I just closed my eyes. There are these seven loaves, moldy, stale, and the one that was fresh baked that day. Please don't let me die. There is a plant at the bottom of the sea. Find it, and he'll give you eternal life. I'll get it, Gilgamesh says, and he leaps down into the water, brings it up, lays it aside, falls asleep again, and he wakes up, a snake has eaten it, and slithers away, shedding its skin. He will never know eternal life. He will die. Gilgamesh knows it. No man or woman could try as hard as he did, but he will die. He makes his way back then to Uruk, and he stands amidst the walls of Uruk and climbs upon the walls and says, I built this city. I built these walls, 1 mile square of townhouses, 1 mile square of gardens, 1 mile of clay pits, and a half mile square devoted to the goddess. What I have done is good. So he lived his life knowing he would die, and all that mattered is the reputation and the achievements he left behind.